This is the second half of a sermon that I began last week. It's actually the last third of it, but it'll take as much time as the first half of it to do that. In Genesis, we have two contrasting characters. We have contrasting characters in Abraham and Lot. Abraham is a man who is very sensitive to the Lord's will. He is seeking what God would have for him, and he is following the Lord's plan. And of course, during that time, he goes through some bumps in the road. He is not a perfect man, but he is a man who is truly seeking the Lord's will. We also have Lot, a man who comes across as very selfish, a man who wants the possessions, but he doesn't seem to have an understanding of the position that God should have in his life. And as you study these two characters, we have glimpses of Lot in the midst of the story of Abraham. That glimpse ends with Genesis chapter 19, when two angels go to the city of Sodom. And we began reading in verse 1 last week, and I want to read there again just to put the foundation down. Genesis 19, beginning at verse 1, it says, "And there came two angels to Sodom at evening, and Lot sat at the gate. And Lot sat at the gate of Sodom. And Lot, seeing them, rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground." Now, what we found last week is that Lot had gone through a progression. I've asked you a couple of questions. I have actually four questions that we'll ask. And the first two questions we looked at last week, that was the question of how did Lot get to Sodom? What we know about Sodom is that God has already told us that it is an exceedingly wicked place. It's an awful place. It is a place where sin abounds, and sin is crying out to God. He'll say that in this passage, that the outcry of Sodom to God is that it is crying out for judgment, actually, is the idea that is given there. How did Lot end up living in the midst of Sodom? Well, you follow his progression, and you find that back in chapter 13, that when he was given the choice as to the direction that he was going to go, he pointed himself toward Sodom. The King James says that he pitched his tent toward Sodom. In chapter 14, we come to another passage that tells us that he was actually living in Sodom. And when five kings went to battle with four kings, they took Sodom and all of his, or Lot and all of his possessions into captivity, and Abraham rescued them. Well, that tells us a little bit about Lot, that he has gone from pitching his tent toward Sodom to actually moving into Sodom. And now we find him in Genesis 19:1 sitting at the gate of Sodom. And we don't know how much to read into that, but it would seem that he has now become very comfortable in Sodom, and he has become part of the administration of Sodom. He is there with the men, and he's conducting business, and we don't know that he's become involved in the activities of Sodom, but he's certainly very comfortable in that city, and he is a part of the city, and he's a part of the activities that are going on there. And so here's a man who made some poor decisions as he came to a place in his life where he was going to decide what he was going to do. And that brings us to the theme of the message, really, and that is that there are four questions that will help us make wise spiritual choices. The story of Lot is given to us not so that we can simply entice ourselves with all of these activities that took place, but instead so that you and I can learn from the man and we can make wise spiritual choices. And that's what I want you to do. As a pastor, I want you to look at life and say, all right, what should I do next? What would be the wise thing for me to do in making this choice in my life? And the first question that we ask, how did Lot get to Sodom? The real point of it is that it was not one giant step. It was a series of small steps. My concern is generally not that somebody will be sitting here in this auditorium today and they'll go home tonight and tomorrow morning they'll wake up and decide, you know, I think I'm just going to live a horribly sinful life. Now, that could happen. There are people who have done that. They've just abandoned things and done it. That's not generally the way it happens. It is usually a progression of small steps that lead you to a place where you're in essence living in Sodom. We looked at 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 7 when we began last week, and that verse tells us that Lot was a righteous man, and other than that passage telling us that, we probably would not come to that conclusion, but twice in that passage he's called righteous, and it tells us that he vexed his righteous soul. He tormented his righteous soul with the ungodly living that was going on in Sodom. Here was a man who tortured himself by the things that were taking place. And he decided, he made decisions that led him to Sodom, to living there. And then we ask a second question, why did Lot move to Sodom? Well, we have to speculate just a little bit, but there are some concrete things that we come up with as we read the scripture that leads us to this point. And one was that his focus is on the wrong things. When he was given the choice about the direction that he was going to go, Uncle Abraham says, you go this way and I'll go this way, or you go that way and I'll go that way, however you want to do it. Lot's decision was based upon the material things. This is where the greenest grass is. This is where my flocks and herds are going to do the best. He did not take into consideration the wickedness that Sodom held and the temptation that it would be for his family. And so he made his choice based upon the wrong things. I believe he also thought he could handle it. There was naivety in his thinking, where he thought he could be around it, or possibly arrogance. It won't affect me. He didn't realize the gradual progression of sinful choices. He didn't realize how patient Satan is. And we don't want to exalt Satan, certainly, but Satan is certainly willing for you to take a year to slide into sin. He is happy with that if he can do that. He didn't have a healthy fear of sin. And you and I have to cultivate that fear of sin. And so here are two questions that we've thrown out already. How did Lot get to Sodom? Well, it was a slow progression. It didn't happen just in one giant step. Number two, why did Lot move to Sodom? And we'd have to conclude because his focus was on the wrong things. He was not really focusing on the Lord at all. He was focusing on himself and what he could do. But there are two more questions that I want you to consider, and they'll overlap a little bit. But one of them is because I want to, and I've mentioned this, that some teaching on Wednesday night and some on Sunday is going to collide into this message. I want you to understand something about our church and about our history and about the choices you make. The third question that I'll ask you is, what led him to make these spiritual choices? Now, I understand that there's just a slight difference between why did Lot move to Sodom and what led him to make these spiritual choices. And the basis of that is, I want to go back into his mind and into studying him and think, what was he missing that would allow him to make some choices that allowed him to move into Sodom? What was wrong? What did he need to have in order to have made or come to a conclusion, I shouldn't do this? And so let's ask the question, what led him to make these spiritual decisions? Well, I'm going to say, number one, he didn't consider the impact of his decisions on other people. He was very self-centered. I've mentioned that before. He was a man who didn't seem to look around him and consider even his Uncle Abraham. He didn't seem to consider his family. But he was a man who looked around and he said, I am going to do what seems best for me. And in looking at that, I really believe Lot looked at Sodom, and he studied it. He knew it was a wicked place. And I think he really, truly believed that when he moved into Sodom, that he was not going to get involved in their sin. And I am not sure that he ever did. Now, the one thing that would cause me a little bit of uneasiness with that decision is the ease with which his daughters get him drunk at the end of chapter 19, and a slight implication that perhaps when he went to talk to his son-in-laws, that they may have thought he was drunk when he was telling them that God is going to judge the city. Maybe he had a problem with alcohol. I can't say that dogmatically. But otherwise, the Bible calls him a righteous man. And I believe that when Lot looked at Sodom, he looked at those sins and he thought, I am never going to be involved in homosexuality. I'm not going to get involved in the bar scene. I'm not going to get involved in some of the other things that are temptations in Sodom. Look, I am just too solid for that. And it may be that that man was thinking that, and it could be that he's right, that he didn't. But he failed to think about his family. He failed to think about all of the other people around him that were going to be influenced and affected by the choices that he made. And it might be that you could look at something and say, well, you know, I'm not going to get involved in that. I know better than that. I've had experience with life, and it's not going to affect me. But you don't take into consideration the people around you. And you know, God expects us to do that. God expects us to think about other people. When you choose music, it might be that this music is something that you can say, I'm going to listen to this and I'm not going to listen to anything else. but it might lead someone else to another step in it. You might say, I'm going to do this, and it's never going to go any further, and you may have the discipline not to do it, but you're opening the door for some other people. And I think especially of Lot's family. You know, when he went to leave, his wife and his daughters and his sons-in-law completely resisted him. I've heard it said that he was trying to get them out of Sodom, but he couldn't get Sodom out of them. They had lived there so long that whether Sodom ever got into Lot or not becomes a non-issue because Sodom had infiltrated his family. And here was a dad that didn't look at the situation and say, I need to protect my children. He was willing to move into the midst of an exceedingly sinful place and let his family be exposed to that and not take into consideration how it was going to affect them. Whether or not he could resist the sinfulness of Sodom was not the issue. Whether his family could, whether they should be exposed to it or not, was an issue he should have considered. And so here's a question that then practically you have to look at. It is you looking around you and saying, all right, I might be able to say I have some liberty, if we want to use that word. A whole discussion goes with that, but I have some liberty to do with that. How's it going to affect everybody else? What about the rest of the people who are watching you? Lot was responsible for his family. He was responsible for those he was supposed to be a testimony to, and he didn't do a very good job with it. Here's the second thing that we'd put down when we say what led him to make these spiritual choices, and that was that he was ruled by his flesh. He was ruled by his flesh. Again, we're in a little redundancy here, but I think it's worth pointing out again, if we want to know what's at the root of his decision-making process, here's a man who is ruled by his flesh. There is obvious selfishness that comes up. There is some ingratitude that seems to be just jumping off the page at us when he talks about his uncle Abraham, doesn't take him into consideration. And there seems to be a hedonistic way of thinking. Now, I use that term once in a while, but it's important to define it. Hedonism is living for pleasure. And it is the whole idea, if it isn't fun, I don't do it. That is hedonism. And that is what most of us are exposed to today. People would say, I don't go to church because, man, they have a 35, 40-minute sermon there, and that's no fun. So I don't go. That's living with a hedonistic philosophy of life. I don't do things that aren't fun. And if I don't enjoy it, why should I do it? Well, how about because it's right? How about because you're told to by God? God's philosophy is not a hedonistic philosophy. His philosophy is building character and doing right to the glory of God, whether you feel like it or not. Your feelings are irrelevant in some decisions. There are going to be things you do because they're right, not because they make you feel good. And the fact is that you may feel good after you do the things that you don't feel like doing. And so here's a man who is being ruled by his flesh. He makes decisions based upon how he feels. He makes decisions based upon what he wants to do. He doesn't ever come across to us. Do you realize this? That never do we have a picture of Lot looking toward heaven and saying, God, what do you want me to do next? Again, let me say that we never have a picture of Lot doing that. Not once. It is always Lot just making decisions and doing it, and never considering what God would have him to do. He's a man who's ruled by his flesh. Here's the third thing that I'm going to put under what led him to make these spiritual decisions, and this is going to be a long one, so I'll warn you. If you don't like history, it's going to be a boring one, all right? How many of you don't like history? Oh, don't tell me that, because I'm afraid I'll bore you, all right? But I got to give you a little bit of history here. You know, we've talked on Wednesday night about the fact that one of the dangers to churches and to Christians is that we don't learn from history. And you know the saying, those who don't learn from history are, you're destined to repeat it. Yeah. And so, if you don't learn from what has happened in the past, you're just going to do it again. And so, Sodom is in a position where they've not learned from the past, and they're going to repeat it. Well, what was in the past? Well, how about Genesis chapter 6? Where God looked at the world and said the imagination of the thoughts of his heart is only evil continually. And because of that, God judged the entire world. Well, we move forward just a few chapters, and man decides in rebellion against God again to build the Tower of Babel, and judgment falls upon sin. And Cain has already demonstrated that. And up into the short existence of humanity in Lot's time, he could have looked at the little bit of history and said, you know what? I've come to a conclusion that God isn't real thrilled with sin. He judges sin. He could have easily come to that conclusion. But here he is, moving into the center of a city that is described as exceedingly sinful before God. He hasn't taken history into consideration. He's not learned from the past. You and I have way more than that that we can learn from. We can look through the whole Old Testament and we can see that a cycle comes out. The people, Judges is a great example of it. We use that on Wednesday night. The Judges gives us the cycle that people still fall into today, where they're in sin and God brings them to a place of judgment, and then there's supplication, and then there is salvation that God brings them out of it, and then there's a period of silence where people just generally backslide again, and then they make choices and fall into sin, and then there's servitude. And that the cycle repeats itself over and over. You know, people still do that? That same cycle is still in play all the way through to the New Testament. It got so bad that that cycle was being repeated that God let Israel go into captivity. God let Israel almost go out of existence, and apart from His promise to them, He probably would have because of their sinfulness. You and I have the ability to look at history and say that God hates sin. God will judge sin. And there is a cycle that people go through, and if we don't learn from that cycle, we're going to repeat it. You know, when we look at that, I want to give you a little bit of a history of fundamentalism, all right? Because I think this will be a good illustration for us, because I don't want us to repeat the cycle. Now, when you hear the word fundamental, there are a couple of things that come to mind. If you look it up on the internet, you'll find that it's often described as fundamental Muslim or fundamental Islamic or fundamental Jewish, and those are the really radical groups. They're blowing people up and they're driving cars into buildings and trying to kill as many people as they can. And really, fundamental Christianity has been painted that way a little bit. And there's been discussion about should we still call ourselves independent fundamental Baptist churches, because the idea of fundamental is sometimes radical. But I want you to understand, when we say this is an independent fundamental Baptist church, what does that mean? Because I would say that if I were to ask most of you, what does that word mean, you would say, we're independent and we're fundamental. What does it mean? I don't know. Some of you were here about 5 years ago when I did a little demonstration of something with New Evangelicalism. But let me give you a history of that word, because I think it's important for you to know, and I think it will influence some of your choices. Now, I'm going to give you just a snapshot of history. It is not going to be a detailed, in-depth history, and it's not as clear-cut as what I'm going to give it to you. You'd have to do some reading on it. There are a couple of books. Mark Sidwell has one out that is a great book. There's one called The Tragedy of Compromise by Ernest Pickering that goes through some of this history. But, you know, in our history, in our time period, I think the oldest person here, I don't know who the oldest person here today would be, and I better not go into that because it could be a lady. But we have, I know that Mrs. Lake and Papa Moses are both 90, well, one's 94, one's 95, so that'd be 1906, I believe. But before 1906, in the 1800s, you had the Age of Enlightenment. The Age of Enlightenment sounds wonderful, but it was awful. The Age of Enlightenment was when the great philosophers came to the point where they said, you guys are really bound up with these religious traditions and you're bound up with these religious rules. We need to start thinking for ourselves. And enlightenment to them was that I come to the place where I begin to make observations on my own and I come to my own conclusions. And when I see something that doesn't make sense in my mind, I reject it. All right, real oversimplification of that, but that is kind of the idea of what the Age of Enlightenment was. Now, that's fine for the secular world. They're going to come to things like that. They're going to believe all kinds of wacky things, like, you know, if you watch, you're going to, the global warming, they've come to this real radical conclusion that the earth is going to burn up. I think I read that in the Bible. But they come to these things that they're just, oh, we're going to have to save the earth because in 2,000 years it's going to get hot. But they come, that's fine. Without God in their thinking, they're going to get some really wacky ideas. Okay? And in the Age of Enlightenment, they rejected everything that didn't have to do with rationalism and reasoning. And if I can't make it make sense, then I'm going to throw it out. And I can't see God. I can't touch Him. You can't really show Him to me. And so, let's toss Him out. The problem is not that. The problem is when that kind of thinking begins to infiltrate the church. And that's what happened. And over the course of time, you had that kind of thinking begin to affect and influence those who were studying the Scripture. And so here is a scholar that reads through, and as he's reading through the Bible, he comes to the resurrection. And in his mind, as he begins to talk about this, he says, you know, I read that Jesus Christ was killed, and then he was put in a grave for 3 days, and, you know, I'm just having trouble with that. Because I've never been able to see that. I've never experienced that. I have no reason to believe that that could actually happen. And then we go back and we look at all those things that Jesus apparently did, all of those miracles, and the fact is that we're progressing as humanity, and we need to progress in our understanding of God. And the fact is that I just can't buy all of those miracles. All right, here is the Age of Enlightenment now permeating the church. And as you come to the 1900s, those early years, that was what was beginning to happen. That you would have some mainline preachers beginning to stand up, and they would say the Bible is not really an infallible book. It is a nice guideline for us so that we can understand a God, and we can get ideas out of it, but we have to go through and kind of pick and choose. And you have some, Schleiermacher was one of the guys, and he would go through and pick out portions that he'd say, this is accurate, and this one's not, and this is not, and you don't have to really believe this, but you have to believe this, and really picking apart the Bible. Well, if you're a Bible-believing Christian, what's your response to that? Well, it was exactly what it should have been. In the early years, they rose up and they started talking about, hey, something is wrong here. We're having in our mainline denominations things taught that are just not right. Things that are incorrect. And so they started having conferences and they started really gathering together and teaching things. And in between 1910 and 1915, a Christian businessman, probably two of them, joined together, and they had a series of 12 pamphlets published called The Fundamentals. And what these were 12 pamphlets that went through, and they were mailed out to thousands of churches. Any pastor who wanted them could order them, and they would send them to him free. He would pass them out to his congregation, and they were things on the deity of Christ, the resurrection, on miracles, on the rejection of Darwin's theory of the origin of species. And they would go through, and they went through 12 fundamentals, and they sent these out to churches. And during this time, it was a time of expulsion, where the real Bible-believing conservatives were in the mainline denominations, and they were looking at some of these men, and they were saying, you can't continue to teach that and be in our denomination. And they even set up tests and said, you have to say you believe these five things at least. And they were really fighting for the denominations. Well, after the course of several years, those fundamentals had gone out. You still weren't known as a fundamentalist, but that's where fundamentalist comes from. We'll get that term in just a second. After some time, some of these liberals or modernists began to win. And then we came to a point where the liberals and the modernists in the Northern Baptist Convention, there was a creed that was a fundamental creed, and they rejected that creed in favor of a great sounding statement. We have the New Testament as our creed in the Northern Baptist Convention. Well, it sounds wonderful. but it was actually a rejection of specific things. We're going to leave the door open for some of these other people who believe some of these other things. And now the Northern Baptist Convention has decided we're going to open our doors to a lot of people. You're the fundamentalist. What do? You're the conservative. And at that point, many of the people came to a place where they had to decide, am I going to stay in this convention or am I going to pull out? And it wasn't just Baptists. The Presbyterians went through this. There was a battle in the Methodist church and Baptists, and you had all kinds of battles going on within these churches. And finally, some of these men very courageously got together and said, we have to leave our denomination. That was hard for them. Really hard. They had invested their lives in these denominations. They had their pensions sometimes in these denominations. They lost part of their congregations because the congregations were allied to the denomination more than them. They made some very courageous decisions. They pulled out of those denominations. Shortly after that, they became known as fundamentalists. Now, during the next period in that controversy, 1919 to about 1936, you had some real public relations disasters. Three men were at the forefront of this, and you'll have different names that will come up, but Riley, W.B. Riley, J. Frank Norris, and then up in Canada, T.T. Shields. And J. Frank Norris had a little problem because he shot a man in his office. And that was a public relations problem. Now, he probably was truly threatened, but he was painted as just a real radical. And then they tried to take one of the Northern Baptist Convention colleges. They tried to turn it back to conservatism, and the students rioted and ended up shutting the college down. Again, it was a public relations disaster. The Scopes trial, you remember that? That's where Scopes was put on trial for teaching evolution in a classroom. And actually, the conservatives won the court case. But the public perception of fundamentalist and Bible believers was so horrendous that they really came out with a black eye. And even though they won the court case, people looked at them now as kind of a weird bunch. But here is a group of people who have made a courageous decision. There has been in our history, and remember this is why I'm telling you this, in our history as a fundamentalist, less than 100 years ago, there have been people who have looked at the church, the denominations, and said, there is false teaching, they're headed in a wrong direction, they're making wrong decisions, they're headed toward Sodom. And you look at some of those denominations now, who are now ordaining homosexuals. Some of those denominations now, you couldn't find the gospel if you took a shovel and dug for it in the church. It's not there. And these men courageously looked at that and said, we can't stay in it. We can't hang with this group. We've got to separate. And so they did. And that became one of the key factors. We've got to separate based upon our understanding or our belief in the fundamentals, that we cannot compromise on these things. We can't give in. You come to the 1950s and 1960s, and you had a man named Billy Graham. Ooh, someone will want to throw rocks when I mention that name. But Billy Graham came to New York City, and he was doing one of his crusades, and he made the statement, I will preach the gospel in any church, no matter what they believe, as long as they don't put restrictions upon my message. Now, on the surface, that sounds great. But he is allowing liberal people to come in and participate in his crusade, and then he's sending those people back to those liberal churches. There's a whole group of men who have sacrificed their lives, their livelihood. They have spent time in the 20s and 30s battling this thing, trying to stay out of this. And now a man stands up and says, we're going to go back in it. And that's where this separatist idea really came from, when some men who listened to Billy Graham preach, and he's preaching the gospel, and people are getting saved, and there's no doubt about it that they're getting saved. But on the side of this, he's also saying, we're letting the liberals back in. This modernism doesn't bother us. And so they had a conference, about 150 very fundamental pastors, and they signed a document together. Some of the names on it you'd recognize. You had John R. Rice and Bob Jones Sr. who were heading it up, and you had Jack Hiles signing it, and some of the names that now you and I would begin to recognize in our time period that began to sign this document and say, we cannot be involved with this Billy Graham because he's repeating history. He's doing the very thing that we know we're not supposed to do. We just fought that battle. We can't go back in it. And now over and over, we've got this same thing. So a fundamentalist is one who has looked at the Scripture and said, you know, there are some fundamental things that I cannot compromise on. I can't compromise on the clarity of the gospel message. I can't compromise on the deity of Jesus Christ. I can't compromise on the virgin birth of Jesus Christ. I can't compromise on the authority of the Bible, the inerrancy of the Bible. I can't compromise on, and we go down a list, and nobody has the exact list. It changes from time to time because of the attacks of Satan. But there are some things that we cannot compromise on. And that's what fundamentalism is. And when you hear on the news that we're this bunch of radical fundamentalists and we're going to blow things up, that's not what fundamentalism means in our church settings. Fundamentalism means that there was a group of people who banded together and said, we're not going to give up on the fundamentals. We're going to separate because we see the direction that things are going. And unfortunately, you look at Billy Graham and read some of the statements that he made later in life, He stated clearly on a major news network he wasn't sure he believed in the reality of hell. And he stated later that he wasn't sure if some of these people who were real sincere in Islam might go to heaven. You know, we have a problem with that. Because it's in conflict with what the Bible says. But see, it's not simply that one messenger, that one message. It is you and I learning from history where we come to the place where we say, we've got to make some decisions because it's not about just this one incident. It is about how it's going to affect everything around us. How it's going to affect my family. How it's going to affect my church family. How it's going to affect us in the future. And here was what Lot was missing. He didn't understand his history. He hadn't taken the time to learn that there's a reason that we do not participate in some things. There's a reason that we don't fellowship. And if you would just take the time to read, you would understand. But there's a really, really good reason for it. And there's some people in the past who have done or not done some things, and because they have done or not done some things, you and I know that we probably shouldn't do that. And there are all kinds of areas where we know that's true, that we read, somebody did this, it didn't work, so I'm not going to do it again. But what about spiritually? There are people who you can go back and read who have made some really poor spiritual decisions, and when they made those really poor spiritual decisions, it led them to Sodom. But right here in this room, there will be people who are still struggling with their spiritual decisions. Read the story of Lot. I want to go back to the passage of Scripture because we haven't read through it yet. And with that in mind, I want you to think through the whole history that he should have known. And let's read through what happened in his life. Let's go back to Genesis 19 and begin reading in verse 2. These two angels are at Sodom and they're talking to him. In verse 2 it says, "And Lot said, Behold now, my lords, turn in, I pray you, into your servant's house and tarry all night and wash your feet, and you shall rise up early and go on your way. And they said, No, but we'll abide in the street all night, or we'll spend the night in the square. And Lot pressed upon them greatly," or strongly, "and they turned in unto him and entered into his house, and he made them a feast, and did bake unleavened bread, and they did eat. But before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot and said unto him, Where are the men which came in to thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may have relations with them. And Lot went out at the door unto them, and shut the door after him, and said, I pray you, or please, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold now, I have two daughters which have not known men. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as is good in your eyes, only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof. And they said, stand back. And they said again, this one fellow came to our sojourner as an alien, and now he is acting like a judge, or will needs be a judge. Now we will deal worse with thee than with them. And they pressed sore against the man, even Lot, and came near to break the door. But the men put forth their hand and pulled Lot into the house to them and shut the door. And they smote the men that were at the door of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they were wearied themselves to find the door. Let's stop there for just a moment. Is that how you want your family to end up? Are those the kinds of decisions that you want to have to make? That you've made the decisions to move towards Sodom and now God's people are there and you know what's going to happen if they sleep in the square. Well, you're really tormented. But you've made decisions and you're in the situation now where you live in the midst of it. And these two men are now at your door and they're under the protection of your house, and so the men of the city surround them and want to have homosexual relations with these men. And so you have to protect them. And in order to protect them, you have to offer your two daughters to this mob. You see, Lot was a man who was greatly conflicted. He had been so permeated by worldliness that he didn't know what to do. There were no good choices at this point. Have you met people like that? Boy, I've struggled with that at times as a pastor. Where somebody will come to me for counsel after, you know, 20 years of marriage and 20 years of wrong decisions in their family and 20 years of moving towards Sodom and now living in it. And boy, I wish I could help them. But I got to tell you, if Lot could slip out and come to my office right in the midst of this and say, Pastor, what do I do? I don't know. It's a problem. You see, you've made these conscious decisions all of your life and you've kept moving towards Sodom. You've made poor spiritual choices and this is what happens. I don't know what to tell you, Lot. I wish you would have listened a long time ago when God let you go into captivity. Your uncle came and rescued you and you came back to Sodom. You should have said then, I better get out of here. This is not the place for a Christian. And now it's so influenced my children, it's so permeated them, that I don't know what to do. And I don't know how to help you. Let's go on in the passage. Begin reading again at verse 12. And the men said unto Lot, hast thou any here besides, son-in-law, and thy sons, and thy daughters? And whosoever thou hast in the city, bring them out of this place. For we will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxen great before the face of the Lord. And the Lord hath sent us to destroy it. And Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked or jested unto them, unto his sons-in-law. And when the morning arose, and the angels hastened Lot, or they urged Lot, saying, arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters, which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And while he lingered, the New American Standard says, but he hesitated. Boy, what a state he's in. The men laid hold on his hand and upon the hand of his wife and upon the hand of his two daughters. And the Lord being merciful or compassionate unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without or outside the city. And it came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad that he said, escape for your life. Look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain or the valley. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. And Lot said unto them, oh, not so, my Lord. Behold now, thy servant hath found grace in thy sight, and thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast showed unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape to the mountains, lest the disaster overtake me, or some evil take me, and I die. Behold now, this city is near to flee unto, and it is a little one. Well, let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. And he said unto him, see, I have accepted thee concerning this thing also, and I will not overthrow this city for the which thou hast spoken. haste or hurry. Escape thither, for I cannot do anything till thou come thither. Therefore the name of the city was called Zoar. The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. And the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley or the plain, and all the inhabitants of the city and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Let's stop reading there. Here is the end of the story. You know, I ask you three questions. I ask you, how did Lot get to Sodom? Why did Lot move into Sodom? And what led to him making these spiritual choices? Here's a man who has failed to learn from history. Here's a man who could look back and see how sin destroys. Making sinful choices, moving as close to Sodom as you can, it is an awful decision. It's an awful choice. And you've got to make choices that are going to lead you away from sin instead of towards sin. And I would look at you and say the same thing. If you will take the time to study our history, we have a cycle that continues to take place where if we're not careful, we begin to make choices that move us back toward that liberalism, that modernism, that worldliness. And you look at me and say, it's just one little decision. It is not the giant step that I'm concerned about. It is a bunch of little decisions that move you away from the Lord. And that is exactly what happened to Lot, and the end result is actually what you see. The last question I would ask you is the shortest. What is the consequence of his spiritual choice? Lot lost everything. He never planned to end up in this situation, but if you list the things that he lost, you could list that he lost his fortune, he lost his family, including his sons-in-laws. He lost his friends, because it seemed like his friends were now in Sodom. He lost his future. He lost his wife. He lost his testimony. He just lost all the way around. And what he became for us was, instead of somebody like Abraham that is revered in history and the father of the Jewish nation and he's looked up to, he becomes the man I'm preaching about today as an example of making poor spiritual choices. I don't want you to become like that. But you're going to have to look around you and you're going to have to realize that it is not a matter of me as a pastor standing up and saying, okay, you can do this and you can't do this and you can do this and you can't do this and you can and you can't and you can and you can't. It is a matter of you looking at your life and saying, what is going to make me grow spiritually? What is going to draw me closer to the Lord? Because all of the questions are not black and white. But there is a black and white question. Is your decision moving you toward Sodom or toward the Lord? And if you're making decisions that are allowing you to draw just a little bit closer to the world, how close can I get without actually being in the world? That's the wrong question. Remember, that's the question that people ask who are wanting to get as close to the world as they can in their music and their activities without actually being in sin. Where's that line? I don't know. But that's the wrong question. The Bible says, draw near to God, and He'll draw near to you. You see, in your mind, you have to ask, is my mindset, when I make spiritual choices, is my mindset that I'm asking, how can I draw nearer to the Lord? So I'm going to listen to this music. Does it draw me nearer to the Lord or nearer to Sodom? I'm going to watch this television program. Does it draw me closer to God or closer to Sodom? I'm going to be involved in these activities, closer to God or closer to Sodom. And you see, they're not all black and white. It's a mindset. Lot's problem was a philosophical one. Not just a matter of tell me what decision to make. I can't do that. But I can tell you it's a philosophical problem. And the philosophy is, I either want to be as close to the world as I can and still be considered righteous, or I want to be close to God. I want to draw near to Him. And my decisions are going to be based upon the philosophy that I've adopted into my life. And Lot gives us a great illustration of that. So the question is, are you going to learn from history? What I don't want to happen is that in 10 years I would be preaching through this again, and in my mind I would be thinking, yeah, I could give you a modern day example of that, We had this teenager in our church. And this young lady made decision after decision after decision after decision, and she's in Sodom now. We had this young guy in our church, and he got saved, but he made decision after decision after decision. And I'm not really questioning his salvation, but he lives in Sodom. He torments his soul daily. He's vexed because his philosophy has been, how close can I get to the world and still be okay with God? If you're asking that question, it's the wrong question. The right question is, how can I make sure I'm living for God, drawing near to Him? And when you change that philosophy, when you change that at the foundation, it makes life so much easier. Because then you're making decisions based upon the fact that you want to draw near to God and see Him draw near to you. Are you making those decisions? If you look at your life right now, are you moving toward Sodom or toward God? If you study Lot's life as a whole, you can learn from history, and it'll save you a lot of pain and a lot of turmoil. And I hope you'll do that. Let's bow for prayer, please. With our should be enough warning for each of us to say, I don't want to be there. Will you yield to the Lord as He tugs at your heart? Resisting Him won't lead to blessing. It will lead to destruction. Please, as always when we finish here in this building, if God is dealing with your heart and you need to talk with somebody, just say something to us. We'd be happy to sit down and answer your questions. The most exciting thing for you will be when you realize that yielding to the Lord is not a burden, it's a blessing. You'll be more joyful and happier than you've ever been. It doesn't mean it'll be a trouble-free life, but you'll understand what God is doing, and I encourage you to really look for Him in your life and really try to draw close to Him. We're going to be dismissed in prayer in just a moment, and then we have choir practice at 4:45 tonight, and then the service at 6 o'clock, and don't forget we have a diaper shower after the service. I'd love for you to stay for that as well. Todd Lewis, will you dismiss us in prayer, please?